This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. Today, a review of Fukushima. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Happy holidays. Today on 5 o'clock shadow, we review the clear and persistent danger of a global health crisis from the ongoing nuclear disaster at four of the six nuclear units at Fukushima Daiichi in Japan, where globally unprecedented nuclear releases continue despite ludicrous government and TEPCO insistence that the doomed reactors have achieved what they are cosmetically calling a, quote, cold shutdown, end quote. In a news conference on December 16th, Tokyo Electric Power Company President Toshio Nishizawa called the completion of an untested and desperate crisis a, quote, milestone, quote. But his statement was rendered meaningless by ongoing radioactive releases of uncertain magnitude, probable meltdowns, and documented isotope pollution of local water tables and the entire Pacific Ocean, including its aquatic food chain. Zany plans for an overground tent and subterranean diapers have come to nothing, and even the state of the continuing meltdowns remains unknown. That's why TEPCO is, as of today, attempting an environmentally obscene colonoscopy of Unit 2. The clueless TEPCO operators are now proposing to use an industrial endoscope to study the insides of the doomed reactor number 2 in January of 2012 in order to see what only they refuse to acknowledge about reactor pressure and containment escape of molten uranium fuel that at this moment threatens the local water table and whose cooling water is slaking off into the Pacific Ocean en route to North America. We of 5 O'Clock Shadow recently discussed these issues with Fairwind's nuclear engineer and former plant operator, Arne Gunderson. How do you clean up an entire countryside? There was a 10-mile evacuation. Officials are only slowly and reluctantly admitting the exponentially larger exposures than they officially have admitted. And those numbers keep growing day by day. Tokyo, places that would not be obvious from dominant wind patterns, have been highly struck with this radioactive debris in the wind, not to mention in the Pacific Ocean. How bad is it on both the land and the ocean?
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. How do you clean up a country? Before I get to there, they've just discovered that 80% of the radiation went into the Pacific. Now, that's good because it didn't. If the wind had been blowing the other way, it would have destroyed Japan as a nation. It would have cut Japan in half, north to south. So it was good that the wind blew out to sea for the people of Japan, but it's really not very good for the Pacific Ocean, that's for sure. But how do you do it is, first you have to admit the severity of the problem, and then admit it's going to cost a lot of money. Tokyo Electric is saying they're going to clean this thing up for something on the order of 15 billion U.S. I won't talk in yen because they've got a lot more zeros than we do, but something on the order of 15 billion U.S. dollars. And, you know, I used to do decommissioning of power plants for a living. And I think the Fukushima site alone, not the state, just the site, is going to be something like $50 billion. And then the land mass that's most contaminated is probably going to be another $150 billion after that. So we're looking at $200 billion. And right now there's a question of who's going to pay for that. It looks like the Japanese government is trying to prop up TEPCO, trying not to force them into bankruptcy. But I think the right thing to do would be to sell them, to let TEPCO be sold and use the cash, because it does have a lot of other assets, use that cash to compensate victims and to clean up. Even when that's done, there will be, you know, perhaps another $100 billion. That's going to have to come out of the Japanese government.
Arnie, because of BP in the Gulf of Mexico, I could no longer eat red snapper. Because of TETCO in the Pacific, I can no longer enjoy ahi tuna. There's yet another water problem that I neglected to mention. I'm understanding that that radioactive water has leaked underneath the facilities and possibly encroached upon the water table that serves the nearby population. Have you heard anything like that?
Yes. By the way, you can. I'm advising my friends to eat tuna and salmon this year, because I think the radiation will work its way up the food chain, and by next year it will be something that questionable. But you're right, the floors cracked during the earthquake. The Fukushima site dropped by 18 inches. The land just dropped 18 inches as a result of the earthquake. That was how severe it is. And when land does that, obviously the foundation cracks, and groundwater is coming in and radiation is going out into the soil. Now, what TEPCO is proposing is they're building a berm, a dike, on the ocean side to prevent that radiation from moving into the ocean. But they're not building it on the land side. One of the proposals out, and I think part of the reason is they just don't have the money. They are undercapitalized and unable to do all the things they should be doing. One of the proposals on the land side of the power plant is to put in wells that will pull that water out of the ground and treat it so that it doesn't continue to move inland. If it grows inland, Robert, I think we're looking at 100 years where people will not be able to use that groundwater.
Our guest is Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates. And Arnie, you have, with your prodigious work, often made the point that the engineering liability of the design of the Fukushima plants, or some of them, is one that Americans face as a risk every day throughout the country. Can you speak to the design failures or hazards that are still operating every day here?
Yeah, we have 23 reactors that are identical to Fukushima, of the 104 that are in the country. So about a little more than 20% of our reactors are identical to Fukushima. And I was an expert in a group of citizens petitioned the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to shut these down, including two engineers, me and a gentleman named Dale Breidenbaugh. Dale left General Electric back in 1976 because he recognized the problems in the Mark I design. So these Mark I reactors have, there's a long legacy of problems there. So a group of citizens has petitioned the NRC to shut those down. I don't think the NRC will ever do that. I think they may, over the next 3 or 4 years, insist on safety changes that will make some of those plants uneconomical. But the NRC will not say, this plant is unsafe. They'll say, this plant needs these modifications. And the owners will then say, we can't afford those modifications. And eventually, in 3 to 5 years, I suspect some of these will be shut down, but not all of them.
THX 1138. You also have something to say about what the industry is proclaiming to be the next sliced bread, the new reactor design basis of the AP1000. Do you find anything wrong with that?
Well, it dates back to Fukushima. I had some problems with the AP1000 design before Fukushima, and it had to do with the containment. And I was told by the NRC in no uncertain terms there is zero probability that the containment will fail. And this was last summer. And of course, we had Fukushima where three containments failed in 3 days, and yet the NRC still hasn't changed its mentality. For these new reactors, they're saying it's zero probability that the containment will fail. Well, what happens on this new design is they've got an enormous water tower on the roof. They've got 6 million pounds of water up on the roof of this containment. And the theory is that after an accident, they can turn some valves on and sprinkle the water down over the containment to keep it cool. Well, Fukushima has what's called the loss of the ultimate heat sink, the ability to cool the plant failed. And the NRC is just now beginning to realize this, despite the fact that I said it on CNN back in March. And this loss of the ultimate heat sink applies to the AP1000 design as well. I could come up with about half a dozen ways that that tank at the top could either fail or become plugged. And in either case, the ability of that tank to then cool the containment won't exist, and then we'll have a Fukushima-type event with the AP1000. So I've asked the NRC as part of something called the AP1000 Oversight Group, which is a group of NGOs, non-governmental organizations in the Southeast, to hold up on licensing the AP1000 and spend the next half year trying to look at what happened at Fukushima and apply those lessons to the AP1000. The NRC doesn't seem to want to do that. They want to license this plant with loan guarantees and get a couple of them built, like, right now.
And we know from the WikiLeaks cables that the State Department has put full force behind strong-arming governments around the world to give favorable terms to the manufacturers of the AP1000. So it does appear to be as much a financial issue as it is one of rationality, safety, or efficiency. Our guest is Arne Gundersen of Fairwinds Associates, and this is really an enlightening encounter because we're getting to catch up on so many things that have been developing beneath most public notice and most commercial coverage. And in the 3 minutes or so that we have remaining, Arne, I open the floor to you to apprise our intelligent listeners as to how to be more aware or protect themselves against these hazards.
I am advising our friends not to buy food from Japan, even if there's a claim that, you know, it's passed underneath the radiation detector and there's not much radioactivity. You know, I think for a year or two, it's just a prudent thing to do. You know, on the East Coast, that's really about all we can do. There's going to be a little bit of cesium in all our foods. I mean, my friend's garden showed up with a little bit of cesium. It's everywhere, and it's going to ultimately get in very low concentrations into our food. Not true in the Cascades. There's other things we should be doing there. But really, I think the key now, my biggest concern is what's coming in through the ocean. And your comment about tuna is certainly appropriate. I think we really need to push the government to inspect the fish, especially these top of the food chain fish, which will accumulate cesium and strontium and things like that. Maybe not now, but certainly starting next year. You know, the salmon and the tuna and these large top of the food chain animals. That's probably the most likely source for you and I on the East Coast to pick up a relatively high concentration of radiation would be starting about next year in the fish. The government doesn't want to do that, and they just, I think what's going to take is a shipload of tuna that sets off a radiation alarm in a port or something like that to get people's attention. But the right thing to do would be to monitor the fish and make sure that the concentrations are extraordinarily low.
Arne Gundersen, thank you so much for being with us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow. I hasten to point out to our listeners that there's infinitely more detail and specificity and utility at the website, and it's spelled FAIREWINDS.com, fairwinds.com. And the website is a revelation, and it's maintained by reader support, much as we here are maintained by listener support. And Fairwinds is a 501c3. It's a nonprofit organization, and we certainly hope that our listeners will support your work at the website.
Well, thank you very much, and I'll keep you informed via emails on a daily basis about how it went.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. You just heard a prescient interview with Arne Gundersen of Fairwinds Associates about the scale of the Fukushima disaster. Next, we consider the cynical cover-up of the Japanese government regarding Fukushima radiation hazards by way of this report from guest correspondent Ian Goddard, who exposes the cynical nature of Japan's recent reduction of exposure standards by a factor of 20. Despite scientific and health evidence indicating the callous recklessness and self-exculpation of such a decision, with deadly consequences for children and especially for girls.
Following the Fukushima nuclear disaster, the Japanese government raised the level of allowable radiation exposure from 1 to 20 millisieverts per year, even for children.
On April 19th, the Ministry of Education, Culture, Sports, Science, and Technology announced that the amount of radiation a child can be exposed to in 1 year is 20 millisieverts.
Officials proclaim that 20 millisieverts per year is safe, but is it? We'll test the official claim of safety against established radiobiological science, the same science upon which the United States National Academy of Sciences predicts that 20 millisieverts of radiation will not only cause cancers all across Fukushima, but will primarily kill women and children. We'll also test the official claim of safety against recently published research, such as the largest study of nuclear workers ever conducted. Comprising over 400,000 workers from 15 countries, the study found increased cancer mortality among nuclear workers exposed to an average of 2 millisieverts per year. That's just one-tenth of the allegedly safe 20 millisieverts per year allowed in Fukushima. We'll see that the public is being misled by governments and major media into a false sense of safety regarding nuclear fallout, obstructing the ability of citizens to be fully informed, so that we can make sound decisions that direct our democracies to safe energy futures. So stay tuned as we cover all that and more. The United States National Academy of Sciences is a logical resource to consult about the state of radiation science. And the Academy regularly publishes reports on low-dose radiation risks. The reports are based on decades of epidemiological and radiobiological research from which risk-predicting models are built. The Academy's most recent report provides both raw data and instructions so that you can apply their risk models to a wide range of exposure scenarios. We can therefore find the cancer risk of 20 millisieverts. This is the Academy's data table for estimated cancer cases caused by 100 millisieverts of radiation, stratified by age and segregated by sex. Highlighted in yellow are the predicted number of cases for all cancers per 100,000 persons. Immediately, we can see that the risk of cancer uniformly decreases as age increases, for both males and females. In other words, children are most vulnerable to radiation. Plotting these data yields this graph. This cancer risk graph keeps the shape irrespective of its dose. This shape is therefore the face of radiation-induced cancer risk across the human lifespan. Following the Academy's instructions on scaling the model to specific doses, the y-axis is recalibrated to the predicted cancer cases caused by the allegedly safe 20 millisieverts. And here in turn are recalibrations for 10 and for 2 millisieverts. According to the Academy, there is no harmless dose of radiation. So, obviously 20 millisieverts is not safe. But what's most remarkable is that children, and most especially girls, are the most at risk of radiation-induced cancer. In fact, girls are almost twice as vulnerable as same-aged boys. And a 5-year-old girl is 5 times, and an infant female 7 times more vulnerable than a 30-year-old man. These data from the National Academy of Sciences are freely available to all major media and government officials. Yet rather than informing the public of the actual state of radiation science and the real risks of nuclear power, they lead us instead to believe that 20 millisieverts of radiation is either safe or its effects are a complete mystery.
Residents traveled to Tokyo to protest after the government loosened safety limits, despite the fact that the long-term impact of low-dose radiation is unknown. The long-term impact of low-dose radiation is unknown.
Even worse than a failure to inform, major media lead the public to believe that scientific models of low-dose radiation risk, such as we've just reviewed, don't even exist. Yet outside the media's cocoon of blissful ignorance, science marches forward, further characterizing the risks of low-dose radiation. And the flow of incoming evidence, published since the Academy's last report in 2006, suggests that the Academy's risk model is either accurate or may underestimate risk. In 2007, the largest study ever conducted on occupational low-dose radiation exposure was published. The study contained over 400,000 nuclear industry workers from 15 countries. The study found a significant relation between radiation dose and cancer mortality. The average period of nuclear worker employment in the study was 10.5 years. And the average dose accumulated over those years was 19.4 millisieverts. This implies an average annual dose of 1.85 millisieverts per year. To get a more accurate estimate of the average annual dose, this data table, showing the average cumulative dose and years of employment for each country, is useful. From these data, we find that the average annual dose for the whole cohort was 1.95 millisieverts per year, rounding off to 2 millisieverts per year. The data provided by the study also allow calculation of the median annual dose of the whole cohort, which was lower still, at merely 0.45 or one-half of a millisievert per year. So the representative dose rate among the nuclear workers in the study was at most one-tenth of the 20 millisieverts per year allowed in Fukushima. So with an allowance of 20 millisieverts per year, Fukushima children may receive up to 10 times the dose rate associated with increased cancer among adult nuclear workers. To get a sense of the distribution of exposures over the cohort, 90% of the workers in the study received cumulative doses under 50 millisieverts over their entire period of employment, which overall was 10.5 years on average. So dividing 50 millisieverts by 10.5 years suggests that the dose rate for most of the workers was probably below 5 millisieverts per year, which is just one-fourth of the maximum annual dose for Fukushimans. To get a sense of the distribution of the radiation effect over the 15-country cohort, the authors eliminated each country from the study one at a time to see if eliminating one country's data eliminated the indicated radiation effect. In each sub-analysis, they found that the excess risk ratio, or ERR, was higher than, but compatible with, the National Academy of Sciences' BIR-7 risk model, which was the risk model we previously reviewed. So the indicated radiation effect was not biased by data from any particular country. The authors of the study noted that worker smoking is a possible confounding factor, since lung cancer was common among the workers. However, other smoking-associated cancers showed little relation to radiation dose, and the authors concluded that even if smoking played a role, it cannot fully account for the dose relation of cancer to radiation. So let's recap. The 15-country study, authored by 51 radiation scientists, is the largest study ever conducted of nuclear workers. It found increased cancer risk among the workers. The average worker dose was 2 millisieverts per year. Most workers received under 5 millisieverts per year. And the maximum dose allowed in Japan is 20 millisieverts per year. That's 10 times higher than the average annual worker dose, and 4 times higher than most worker doses. 2 years later, in 2009, Jacob and colleagues analyzed the 15-country study we just reviewed, plus 8 other nuclear worker studies. What makes nuclear worker exposure especially relevant to areas contaminated by nuclear fallout is that both exposure scenarios deliver doses at a slow, persistent rate. And the meta-analysis of Jacob and colleagues suggests that such slow dose rates might be more harmful than fast dose rates. For example, this chart from Jacob et al. Shows excess cancer mortality risk found in 9 studies of nuclear workers. Each study is denoted by a red dot whose rightward displacement from zero risk along the bottom axis denotes the degree of increased risk found in that study. In contrast, the blue dots represent the comparative excess risk among the atom bomb survivor cohort, adjusted to match the sex ratio and average age of the nuclear workers in each study. As we can see, the red dots are usually more rightward displaced than the blue dots, and therefore, most nuclear worker studies found a higher risk of cancer mortality than among atom bomb survivors. This is a significant finding because radiation risk models are largely founded upon fast dose exposures, like from the atomic bomb blasts, and it has been assumed that fast dose rates were more harmful. However, the findings of Jacob and colleagues brings this view into question. As an editorial on the findings of Jacob et al. In the journal Occupation and Environmental Medicine observed, quote, "A number of recent studies challenge the assumption that low-dose rate exposures to penetrating forms of ionizing radiation are less effective at causing cancer than high-dose rate exposures, because risk estimates for people who received low-dose rate exposures tend to be larger than or similar to the corresponding estimates derived from the study of Japanese atomic bomb survivors." End of quote. This graph from Jacob et al. Demonstrates the discrepancy of risk models. The 2 leading risk models are on the left. The second is the National Academy of Sciences cancer risk model we examined previously. Both risk models are based largely on the fast dose rate exposure experienced by atomic bomb survivors. But the third bar on the right represents the higher level of risk derived from the slow dose rate experienced by nuclear workers. So the cutting edge of meta-analytical research suggests that the leading contemporary radiation risk models may actually underestimate the carcinogenic efficiency of low-dose radiation. Science is not only further clarifying the harmful effects of low-dose radiation on large-scale macroscopic levels, but on the microscopic level as well. Recent research has increased the fidelity of data in the low-dose range regarding radiation-induced genetic damage. Chromosomal translocations are a form of genetic damage resulting from the faulty repair of DNA molecules damaged by genotoxic chemicals or radiation. Chromosomal translocations, also known as chromosomal aberrations, are believed to result in many forms of cancer, and an increased frequency of chromosomal aberrations is recognized as an indication of an increased risk of cancer. As such, radiation-induced chromosomal aberrations are fundamental to the causal mechanism of radiation-induced cancer. It has been well documented that medium to high-dose radiation increases chromosomal aberrations, but the influence of low-dose radiation has been less certain. But if this mechanism of radiation-induced cancer occurs at low doses, there would be little reason to doubt that low-dose radiation can cause cancer. In 2010, Bhatti and colleagues published a meta-analysis of studies that examined the influence of medical X-ray examinations on the incidence of chromosomal translocations. They sought to gain greater precision on the impact of low-dose radiation by pooling data from multiple studies. Not only did they find a dose response in the low-dose range, but to their surprise, the frequency of chromosomal aberrations per unit of radiation increased below approximately 20 millisieverts. Moreover, at doses below approximately 10 millisieverts, the frequency of aberrations per unit of radiation increased further still, and by an order of magnitude. Given these findings, evidence for the carcinogenicity of radiation at low doses could hardly be more logically indicated. Let's examine this formally. The hypothetical syllogism is a two-premise argument schema of classical logic of the form. Given that, if it's the case that P, then Q, and if it's the case that Q, then R, then we may conclude that it's also the case that if P, then R. Plugging the scientific evidence we've just reviewed into the hypothetical syllogism, we may reason as follows. Given that, if there's low-dose radiation, then there's more chromosomal harm. And, if there's more chromosomal harm, then there's more cancer. Then we may conclude that if there's low-dose radiation, then there's more cancer. To some degree, this syllogism may be an oversimplification. However, our inputs in this valid argument schema are the outputs of state-of-the-art biological research. We've reviewed both established radiobiology and recent radiobiological research. From this broad scientific base, we've observed that the National Academy of Sciences predicts increased cancer risk from exposures below 20 millisieverts per year. Research published since the Academy's last report in 2006 corroborates that prediction. Recent research also suggests that the Academy's risk model may underestimate cancer risk. Recent research also finds that radiation exposures below 20 millisieverts are associated with genetic damage. Therefore, both historical and cutting-edge scientific research consistently demonstrate that Japan's allowance of 20 millisieverts per year is not safe.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we just heard a special radiological analysis by correspondent Ian Goddard, who presents further information at his own website, iangoddard.com. And finally, we bring this nuclear war back home with this recent presentation by nuclear epidemiologist Marco Keltofen, who addressed the American Public Health Association. The audio was provided to 5 O'Clock Shadow by our earlier heard colleague Arnie Gunderson, whom you will hear at the completion of this seminal analysis of Fukushima hot particles by Milto Keltofen using a crowdsourced database of air filters addressing the previously unreported global hazards of Fukushima.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here. My research work is on not so much radiation, but on the things that carry the radiation to people. So what I've been studying has been what happens to dust after it becomes contaminated and how that dust carries radiation to the human body. I have to say that I have no personal financial relationships with commercial interests relevant to this presentation during the past 12 months. In doing this research, I have a few people I'd like to thank. In particular, I'd like to thank the volunteers of SafeCast. SafeCast is a group of both technical and non-technical volunteers in Japan who have been working since the March 11 earthquake, tsunami, and radiation release to try and document some of the radiation exposures people are experiencing in northern Japan. The central theme of my work is that the dust contaminated with fallout from the Fukushima accidents is the source of human exposure to radiation. And you have probably, if you've seen some of the media coverage of radiation exposure in Japan, you've probably heard a lot of different ways that people have talked about how we're exposed to radiation and how it compares to our daily lives. And I'm actually going to ask for show of hands. Am I allowed to do this?
Sure.
Has anyone heard the radiation in Japan being compared to, say, taking a flight from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C.? Okay. How about to eating a banana? Has anyone heard this one? Bananas have potassium. Potassium has a natural radioactive isotope. So we get a certain amount of low-level radiation from that exposure. The last question, has anyone heard that a little bit of low-level radiation might actually be good for you? This is a hypothesis by Dr. Ed Calabrese that a very small amount of radiation may actually cause what amounts to something analogous to an immunological response. Sorry, I'm a civil engineer. I can't say those medical words. That response is actually a net positive at very, very low levels. So what we're talking about here is a slightly different kind of radiation, where we're looking at a lot of concentrated radiation in a very small particle. So the total amount of radiation we're exposed to might in fact be low, but because we're exposing only a small number of tissues, for instance, for a respirable dust particle, we inhale the dust particle, it's radioactive, it actually is about the same scale of size as a cell in the human lung. And so that radioactive particle is adjacent to a cell. It's going to stay there because it has a long residence time. And so to that particular cell, that's not a very low dose. In fact, that's a high dose, potentially even a lethal dose to that cell. Although overall, it's a very low level of exposure to the entire human body. So let's look at some of the things that were released by the reactors at Fukushima. Radioiodine, iodine-131. This is a short-lived gas. It tends to decay by about half every 8 days. Cesium-134 and cesium-137, these have half-lives of about 2 years or 30 years, respectively. By the way, have people heard this term, half-lives? Talking about radioisotopes. Thank you. Cobalt-60 has a half-life of about 5 years. A whole zoo of what are called fission wastes and neutron activation products. These are the materials that poison nuclear fuels over time when they're in the reactor. And then, of course, the original uranium and plutonium fuels that are in the reactor, and other transuranics, heavier than uranium isotopes like americium and neptunium, which are very specific to that uranium. And for how people are exposed to this radiation, there are several different vectors, several different ways these dusts will actually get into the human body. Number one is going to be the inhalation of airborne particles, followed by the inhalation of resuspended dusts. The difference being, early on in the accidents, we had a lot of material emitted into the air. It's washed out by rain. It falls out as a settled dust. And then over time, the atmosphere clears, but sometimes those dusts, when they collect in a certain place, are going to resuspend, and the air will become contaminated again after a short downtime. People also ingest contaminated foods, The list I've put here, these are foods which have already been found to be contaminated with unacceptable levels of radiation. Things like seaweed, shellfish, beef, milk, spinach, eggs, tea, fin fish. I should add mushrooms and other things that are grown not just in the immediate area of the reactors, but sometimes as much as a couple hundred miles away. And if any of you are used to working with juvenile health issues, and you're familiar with contamination from lead paint in dusts in homes, we also tend to, especially as children, ingest a good deal of soils and dusts. The EPA tells us that the average child is ingesting about a tenth of a gram of dust every day. I don't know about you, but I remember my kids when they were little. They say sometimes it might be as much as a gram or even a gram and a half of dust a day. That's an important way people are exposed to contaminated soils. And lastly, there's dermal contact, getting this material on the outside. So we tried to take a look at certain samples that would tell us a little bit about how dusts are moving through the environment in Japan. So we looked at automobile air filters. We tried this as a qualitative means of trying to capture a large number of radioactive particles so that we could learn about how those particles are in terms of their size, how they might dissolve in human body fluids, to capture enough particles that we could statistically analyze how they would behave in the environment and in the body. As it turns out, the way the average Japanese driver uses their car, the amount of air consumed by a car in Japan is actually on the same order of magnitude as the amount of air that people use day to day. So a car versus a healthy worker will use anywhere between 10 to 30 cubic meters of air a day on average, for the car obviously to burn the fuel. And to follow up on that, we also use a number of quantitative air filters. These are small metered filters running with air pumps that are taking an exact known amount of air and cutting off the specific particle size with a known amount. We can't get as many particles with this method, but we can use it to calibrate what the actual concentration is of hot particles in the atmosphere. We looked at home air filters for people's homes in Japan and in the U.S. We also looked at children's shoes. Children track in a lot of material on their shoes. Children play very hard in outdoor soils, and their shoes tend to pick up any contaminants that are in the soil. We also looked at settled dust in the home, surface soils, and foods and plants in Japan and the U.S. Our air sampling stations were set up at multiple locations. The first sampling station was the one I set up in Massachusetts about 2 hours after I learned of the reactor accidents, because we look at the map and we can see we're at the same latitude as these reactors in Massachusetts. So that over time, we're likely to see some of that material make its way in the atmosphere to us. We also set up facilities in Seattle, San Francisco, Boulder, Hawaii, and multiple facilities in Japan. Just two of them are here on the map. The primary radioisotopes we detected, the things we actually found in our dust samples, the cesium-134 and the cesium-137. Iodine-131, which, as you know, is a thyroid seeker, but with a short half-life. We only saw iodine-131 back in April. And even the samples we had in storage, you could see the iodine slowly decaying those. Cobalt-60, which is another activation product from deep inside the reactor. The cobalt-60 is formed from steels in the reactor that are exposed to radiation. So obviously somehow the steel at the center of the reactor must have come in contact with the atmosphere. And then other fission products as well. This is a quick map. I don't know if anyone has seen this before. This is a general map taken by an aircraft over Fukushima Prefecture that shows pretty much where most of the plume has gone. So if you'll notice, we have evacuation radii. We have a 20-kilometer zone around which people have been evacuated from near the reactors. But in fact, because of the weather and the geography, you can see how most of this material has moved to the northwest. The permissible radiation dose, I'm not going to focus on this for very long. Let me just say that the permissible radiation doses in Fukushima Prefecture were raised by a factor of 20. There's obviously a lot more to this decision than I could ever get into in 15 minutes. Our sampling team experienced a few difficulties in getting the materials they needed. Probably the biggest one is in working with our volunteers, teaching them how to collect these samples safely, get them safely and lawfully to the United States, they can be analyzed. And here's some of the data. One of the first things we did was we took our automobile air filters from different locations, and we opened them up, and you lay the filter paper inside these air filters on a piece of X-ray film and develop them. On the far left, we have an automobile air filter that operated during March, April, and May in Seattle, Washington. It looks clear. If your eyes are really good, you can see one tiny little dot near the center. We have an automobile air filter from Tokyo, and you can see that each one of these black spots represents a radioactive particle that was trapped on the filter paper and exposed the X-ray film. And also we have Fukushima City, which is about 65 kilometers away from the site. This automobile air filter is actually hazardous. My university is annoyed with me because we have to contract to have this filter disposed of as radioactive waste. Unfortunately, you can just imagine what this means for people in Fukushima City, which is not evacuated, and even for the mechanics that are handling these air filters. Here's a look at one of the particles. We're using a scanning electron microscope to actually see the particle itself. This is a hot radioactive particle. It's about 10 microns across, meaning it is a respirable-sized particle. This is one of the very few particles where we found americium, which is a byproduct of plutonium decay. Quick comparison. This is the total radiation in children's shoes from Koniyama, which is in Fukushima Prefecture. This city is actually featured in today's Wall Street Journal. You can see that the total radiation levels in the shoes from Fukushima are higher for these children than in the U.S. And here we have the total amount of cesium, radio cesium, which is probably the most problematic isotope people are exposed to there. And you can see that the cesium levels are more than 166 times higher in the shoes from Fukushima. So these are actually shoes worn by children in schools and brought home. We're finding that the laces and the soles are probably the two key contaminated areas on the shoes, the soles from contact with soils. It's possible that the laces are actually contaminated from contact with the fingers. Since the accidents about 8 months ago, the airborne levels have dropped. The soil levels still remain high in places, but the food chain radiation we're still finding increasing. This radiation is not uniform. There are hot spots, particularly in Fukushima Prefecture, where we might have zones that are relatively radiation-free now that may experience net increases as some of the radiation from hot spots tends to build up. And for an air filter that was run in Noda City, just north of Tokyo, 150 kilometers from the accident site, an indoor home air filter showed 230 picocuries of radiation. I should just say that the U.S. limits radiation in soil is about 5 picocuries. For the United States, in Boston, we had about 1 month period where we saw beta and alpha radiation based on particles increasing. And in Seattle, we actually had a 2 week period where we had 4 to 5 hot particles of radioactive material that was trapped by our quantitative filters in the amount of air that people would breathe in a day. But that radiation seems to have declined. The thing that concerns us the most currently about Japan is that the means of testing radiation is still focusing on total radiation and not focusing on hot particles. And we're still using things like circular evacuation zones. We actually took people from safe areas that were 20 kilometers from the site and moved them into much more contaminated, unsafe areas that just happen to be further away. This is just done without regard to what the actual scientific data should be telling us. Cesium 134 and 137 have become ubiquitous throughout Fukushima and even in Tokyo. And in the U.S., we've seen just a few isolated hotspots where we're detecting cesium from Japan. I think what this tells me is that this 12-mile evacuation zone we set up around the reactors has not been adequate to protect the public health. And before we feel too good about it here in the United States, I should remind you that NRC regulations, in the event of a similar accident in the United States, call for a 10-mile evacuation zone. Thank you.
We have time for one question for Mark Rokantoffin. Are there any questions?
The question is the risk based on a hot particle exposure different from that based on a total body exposure? The way they answer this question is we always say that if you compare like amounts of radiation, is the hot particle different from a total body?
Are there epidemiologic? I mean, I know theoretically there are reasons to be concerned. The question is there epidemiologic?
Yes. Yeah, definitely want to go there. The important thing in that question is the, that little qualification of the same amount of radiation. Because a hot particle has a very long residence time, and because it exposes specific tissues for a long period compared to an external or a photon dose like gamma radiation, you tend to get a lot of concentrated radiation with a long residence time, and your total radiation exposure tends to be higher. When you measure, when you correct or normalize for that radiation exposure, when you artificially raise your external dose to the same as the hot particle, in fact, you find that the hot particle is a little less dangerous because your body acts as shielding. Your tissue is where the hot particle is, shield the rest of your body from that radiation. So the epidemiological studies show a slightly reduced dose. But you've added that huge fudge factor where you've assumed that the external or uniform dose was as big. And that's really hard to do with a short-term dose compared to the years you can have a hot particle in your body. So if you use that fudge factor, you can convince yourself that it's okay. But in real life, the hot particle tends to create a long-term exposure where total radiation goes up more than you would think just based on the size of the particle.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank Marco Kaltofen, Hiro Takaoka, who is the photographer who donated the film. Also, I'd like to thank Safecast and the hundreds of other people who used the internet and provided the raw information to the Boston laboratories that Mr. Kaltofen used in his analysis. And finally, I'd like to thank all of the Fairwinds viewers for the donations that you have made to the Fairwinds site during this holiday season. It's your donations that keep the site vibrant and keep us moving forward with our educational efforts. Thank you very much.
5 o'clock shadow correspondent and source Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates, and before that, Marco Kaltofen, the president of the Boston Chemical Data Corporation. And that concludes today's holiday edition of 5 o'clock shadow with engineering by Kathy Davis, Reggie Johnson, and Michael G. Haskins. We welcome your comments at theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 o'clock shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.